E Arena. And we'll start with those movies. A Dog Called Money was where Irish photographer Seamus Murphy brought music star PJ Harvey to Afghanistan and other parts of the world to film their documentary. La Belle Epoque is a French time-travelling romantic comedy. But I suppose we have to start with the big one, Frozen, the sequel to Frozen, that is. Very creatively called Frozen 2. I wanted it to be called Refrozen, but there you go. They didn't ask me.
My idea was to call it Baltic. as is the way Irish people say, but they didn't go for it.
All right. And that's Michael Pope, whose idea it was. Diane Negra, who's the other of you. Did you have any potential sequel name other than Frozen 2?
No.
You're happy to run with Frozen 2, Diane?
I think Frozen 2 just lays it right out there. I'm fine with it.
Okay. Does what it says in the tin.
Exactly.
But so that we understand where this second tin is going to bring us, Michael, where were we at the end of Frozen 1? What has happened and where were we left?
Elsa had finally settled down to her into her position as the Queen of Arendelle.
Two sisters involved here.
Elsa and Anna, as it's pronounced, even though it's spelled A-N-N-A. And yeah, all was well in Arendelle, and Elsa was there, and Anna had her boyfriend / soon to be fiance. I can't remember his name. Is it Klaus or is he
Christoph?
Christoph, sorry. Yeah. And everything was good, but
you haven't watched the film enough. Obviously, your children don't watch it enough.
I watched Frozen 1 directly before I saw Frozen 2 because I had never seen Frozen 1.
Ah, right.
So I was doing my due diligence there. And let me tell you, 3 hours of Frozen in the middle of November in Ireland is quite something.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to say, let it go.
Let it go, yes. Or I think the anthem for this one is Show Yourself.
All right, for this second one.
One of the biggest numbers in the middle of it. That seems to be the rallying cry, the mantra for this movie.
Essentially, what we had was, you know, the frozen princess in Elsa in Frozen 1, who was not rescued by the kiss of a prince, but rescued effectively by her sister's love. That's what brings her back to the kingdom and makes all things good.
And now Elsa's kind of hearing a siren song coming from a kind of in the distance, a kind of an ever autumnal forest seems to be calling her. And so herself, Anna, and Olaf the Snowman, they all head off in this kind of mystery. It's kind of like, you know, sequel fodder. They head off for a new adventure. Right. Again, the threat is not so much. There's still no real big bad in these movies. Still no real villain. I know we had kind of a late show of a villain in the first one, but still no. The threats are really still all kind of mystical and existential and crystal. And, you know, so there's still it is more about Elsa coming to terms with who she is, Anna, and sorry, got that name again, Christoph. Kind of sorting out their love life. And yeah, I mean, we're not the target audience for this.
No, probably not.
So there's only so much entertainment we're going to get
but
out of
it. But we are the target audience who may, or some people will be the target audience, or with the
parents,
target audience,
they certainly are.
Who 6 years ago may not have been in the target audience and may not have had to listen to this a few times. Not hard to work out why Idina Menzel was cast in the part of Elsa, mostly for her singing, it's probably fairly safe to say. And Let It Go from the original Frozen won the best Oscar, Oscar for best song, rather. Yeah. Now, let's have a little listen to what they're asking us to get excited about in Frozen 2, musically at any rate.
What do you want? 'Cause you've been keeping me awake. Are you here to distract me so I make a big mistake? Or are you someone out there who's a little bit like me, who knows deep down I'm not where I'm meant to be? Every day it's a little harder as I feel my power grow.
I have to say already I'm a little bit underwhelmed. There's no belter involved there, Diane Negra. That's Unknown, which I think they're kind of putting forward as the big song from the sequel, Frozen 2, are they?
It seems that way. I think, you know, one of the sort of tricky aspects of Frozen 2 is that it, and there's been a lot of talk about this, of course.
Yeah, but the trickiest thing it has is Frozen 1 to follow.
Well, but I think there was an expectation, partly because of the way the film was taken up. Mm. The first film, I mean, we seem to be getting set up for a revelation about Elsa's sexuality, which the film actually doesn't deliver, and presumably that's Frozen 3 coming. But so one of the things that does is it takes the significance of that ballad away, so it just becomes cryptic.
Right. So in Frozen 1, we were set up for, it was kind of a feminist, a Disney feminist, was it?
Oh,
a Disney
yeah.
feminist
Disney
take
feminism,
on
okay.
the Hans Christian
Andersen. Which can we say that's not feminism, but
no.
Disney feminism, sure.
But was there something to be praised in that? In what Frozen 1 did before we say what Frozen 2 might be.
I find it very difficult. And what I mean when I say that is that I think that these are films that traffic in female empowerment that's very superficial, very rote, you know, very, very limited. These are princesses after all, right? So this is not really a moment in which dynastic privilege is easy to celebrate, but the films are still doing that. So, you know, to the extent that there's any feminist content in these films, I would find it quite shallow. It doesn't give you a whole lot.
Right, and dynastic privilege is not questioned at all here.
No, well, I mean, one of the things that Frozen represents, of course, is an embedding in that sort of princess culture that we've had with us for quite some time now, and which Disney really does. And so it matters a lot in these films that Elsa and Anna have these neotenous appearances. Are they children? Are they adults? Well, they're a bit of both. That their waists are very tiny. So, you know, Disney's commitment to giving us impossible female bodies, for me, doesn't sit very well with feminism.
In fact, Marina Warner was in with us last week, and she was speaking precisely about that in the case of Frozen, that while there might be something small to praise in terms of the, at least it's an empowerment between two sisters, that you still have the physical aspects of women being presented in a very definite way.
Yes, and in terms of the sequel, I think they're one of the things they're talking about in the publicity is Kristoff being drawn as a more kind of woke male to some extent, because, you know, he comes to Anna in a moment of crisis and says, what do you need? He doesn't perform the traditional rescue.
So Elsa, the Idina Menzel character, is experiencing these calls, these voices, these sirens. Is there something in that? This is a siren calling a woman, as the usual thing, it's the siren calling a man to his doom, but this is a siren calling a woman.
Again, I think Elsa does sort of take a back seat in this. They don't give Idina Menzel quite a lot to do. I don't think she's the most talented voice performer.
In terms of speaking.
Yeah, she's actually not given much to do in terms of, I mean, obviously as stunning as her singing voice is. So there's only so much I can really get from the sorry, there is certainly, it dips its toe in kind of colonialism in terms of this kind of bewitched forest that's kind of trapped under the shroud of kind of fog and mist. And in there lies these two armies who fought each other over this territory many, many years ago. But in saying that, in much the same way as with it's Disney.
It's a Disney form of post-colonialism.
So it's only ever going to be lip service, if that, and it's not really for, it's not trying to get this message across to 8-year-old children, you know?
Well, I suppose an 8-year-old child might say, can I see, please see the film. Let's have a listen to another clip featuring one of our own in the midst of all of this. Ciarán Hinds plays a very gentle troll at the end of this. Yes. So sisters Anna and Elsa are about to set off. Kristoff, I think, is going with them here, isn't he? He's going to be alongside them, but I think Olaf might be in here as well. So they're all having a chat about heading off on this journey to the Enchanted Forest and to kind of sort out Elsa's powers for once and for all. And Ciarán Hinds, as the troll, gives them some warnings.
Kristoff, can I borrow your wagon? And Sven?
I'm not very comfortable with the idea of that.
You are not going alone.
Anna? No, I have my powers to protect me. You don't.
Excuse me, I climbed the North Mountain, survived a frozen heart, and saved you from my ex-boyfriend, and I did it all without powers. So, you know, I'm coming.
Me too. I'll drive.
I'll bring the snacks!
I will look after your people.
Please make sure they stay out of the kingdom until we return.
Of course.
Let's let them know.
Anna, I am worried for her. We have always feared Elsa's powers were too much for this world. Now we must pray they are enough.
I won't let anything happen to her.
There we have it. Ciarán Hinds just at the towards the end of that clip as the gentle troll. And you also heard Kristen Bell as Anna, Idina Menzel as Elsa, Kristoff, Jonathan Graff. Groff? Is that how it's?
Groff,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Olaf, Josh Gad in the midst of all of that. Is there anything in this for, if you're not in the demographic that they're looking at here, which I guess is that kind of 8 to 12-year-old, somewhere in around there, is it? Is there anything in it for the adults who might be going along?
Speaking for myself, not much, but I wouldn't presume for others. I think to go back to the point that was made before, I do think this film is a kind of a mélange of different ideas about the environment. And it, like a lot of other Disney films and animated product in general, it seems to be worried about the imperilment of the earth. It's not terribly coherent, I think, in that regard, but it's trying to do something.
So it's a Disney type of activism even around the environmental aspect as
yeah,
well, is it?
I'd say so, yeah.
Okay. Stars from you, Diane?
Zero.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I know. Is the animation good? Are the songs
okay,
all right?
You're right. The animation is good. Plus 0.5.
I guess you won't be watching it on DVD.
Well, as hard as I found it to be objective, I didn't think it was in any way a bad movie. So I did give it 3 out of 5.
You did give it 3 out of 5. Yeah. You're feeling a little bit more gentle. You really thought it was that in that boring up category, Diane.
This
yeah?
is the kind of film, and I'm marking it low also because of the onslaught of merchandising that we're going to have to endure in the next weeks, months, years.
Oh, we have a completely irrelevant purple little creature that's sort of on fire for.
Yes.
Oh, is this film being released around Christmas?
Yes. Well, there you go.
Maybe that's why we have a small purple thing.
Well, I'm still trying to find out what this little palm sized purple creature with big eyes and.
Right, it's a fire salamander?
Yes. It's, okay. I'm still trying to figure out
what that is. I think it's a cousin of that John Lewis Christmas ad dragon, whatever that thing
okay.
may be.
Dear Santa, can I have a fire salamander? There you go. There's your letter written. Next up, we have A Dog Called Money from director Seamus Murphy. We spoke to Seamus on Tuesday's show. Essentially, what we're talking about here, a journey in some ways through the inspiration, the writing and the recording of a PJ Harvey album. Which on the surface of it sounds like an interesting prospect, Michael.
I don't know much about PJ Harvey aside from maybe a couple of back late in the 90s, but I didn't realise that this album had already been recorded and released 3 years ago when I saw this film the other night, which actually came with a Q&A with the director, Seamus Murphy, as you mentioned. It does... there's a lot to say for people who love photojournalism and kind of different kind of things from around where it goes to Afghanistan and Kosovo and the projects in Washington, D.C. If you're a fan of that kind of thing, fascinating, interesting, incredibly captured and rendered. If you like PJ Harvey, to see her record her whole album in this kind of like custom-made cube with one-sided mirrors in it so people can...
Audience can watch, but they're not aware of the audience outside.
You can stand outside and watch. Yeah. But those two things together, fused together, for me, do not work at all. It's actually quite an uneasy mix for me.
So either one by itself you could have gone with, but yeah, mixed is the problem.
Is the problem for me. It sets a very uneasy tone and almost kind of... To see such struggles and such and the way some of these people were living, to see that kind of cannibalized in this comfortable, kind of glowing white cube in the middle of London with PJ Harvey and a bunch of world music musicians just seemed, I don't know, tone deaf about it. And that pun probably intended. It was just something about it started after the first 20 minutes to start to make me really uneasy.
Well, let's listen to a clip then. And this is a clip, in fact, where PJ Harvey is in... I can't find exactly the country she's in. I'll tell you after we listen to the clip. But she is in Afghanistan, actually, yeah. And she's having tea with these Afghan children. And she wrote down her immediate thoughts when she was there. And that's what the voiceover is. It's not a kind of a... thought through voiceover after the event. It was her immediate reactions, and Seamus then put those over the images that he had shot. And this is her talking about those Afghan children.
Mist on the mountain. Istalif. The boy whistles to the birds. One white dove backflips. Ruins. The same shape as gravestones. Who lived here? When did they leave? The children look into the camera with no affectation. We sit in silence, smile, stare, shy, curious, us and them.
Tashakur.
I hope we know when to leave.
So there you go. That's PJ Harvey. And what we see on screen is a small, I think it's maybe three or four young Afghan children pouring the tea for both the director and for PJ Harvey in that case. Is that an uncomfortable scene? Is it uncomfortable listening there for you, Diane? I mean, Michael has expressed his reservations around it.
I share Michael's view. I think this film has to work really hard to try to avoid placing PJ Harvey in the role of a tourist gathering little bits of authenticity that she'll then use to make art that will then obviously produce revenue. And, you know, the moment I think that where I really felt this actually wasn't till the end credits, when we see that she's been costumed by a high fashion designer. So that juxtaposition of incredible poverty and privilege is a little... It makes you a little squeamish.
But doesn't she refer to another point of the film? She refers to the sandals that she's wearing.
Does.
And she thinks, oh, what am I doing here in my fancy...
reference. I want to say this. I mean, she is a courteous guest. She is a thoughtful guest in the places that she visits. And the film has, I think, one very important attribute, which is that it shows us in very visually compelling ways places that have high geopolitical importance, but that we often don't know anything about and don't see. So I just wanted to see more of these places.
I suppose in particular that Afghanistan and Kosovo might spring to mind,
Syria,
for that. But when you hear Washington, you go, hold on.
But it's not just Washington, it's Anacostia.
It's the Anacostia side of Washington, which is a whole different Washington than the one we usually see.
Yeah, so that to me is the value of the film, and I share you know, these kind of concerns and hesitations about it. But it is stunningly beautiful, but it's trying to do something which I liked, which is to maybe deconstruct that old marketing category of world music. You know, if you go back to Paul Simon and Graceland in the 1980s, and that, you know, this kind of sense when Simon drew upon South African township traditions to make Graceland, there wasn't much of an outcry that I can recall at the time.
But isn't there a great sincerity in her, you know, in what she's saying here, in the fact that even she puts the Washington, herself and Seamus Murphy, put the Washington side of the story up against the Afghan and the Kosovo side of the stories. Syria is mentioned along the way as well, but Afghanistan and Kosovo really are the major components. So they put Washington is making all these decisions that affect the people on the other side of the river in Washington, and that affect the people in Afghanistan, and affect the people in Kosovo. That's a worthy point.
It is, and it was unusual because what you're looking at in the opening few minutes is you are seeing Kosovo and Afghanistan, and you're kind of thinking, okay, we're going to be here on this incredible poverty, this incredible struggle, and this, but then also the character of these places. So it was kind of a surprise to realize that we were going to go to Washington D.C., but this cycle does start to repeat itself quite quickly, you know. So we go back to the studio and does start to reek so slightly of appropriation sometimes.
So, in fact, if the studio section hadn't been there, you might have been more comfortable with it, would you?
Oh, absolutely. Even with PJ Harvey's words. Now, a lot of the time she is kind of narrating what is on screen, which is fine because it is something that you want to let it wash over you, you know, especially with some of the, like, Seamus Murphy's extraordinary.
You like the visuals as well, I think.
It is. And it's not just, like, you know, really pretty images captured with nice filters. He sees his subjects and he's capturing them in a way that you didn't think that you would see. But I might seem a cliche. I am lifted out of it when we go back into this room with these musicians.
So that is the problem for you. Stars overall, then, what are you saying?
Two for me. Yeah, two.
Two for me.
Yeah.
What are you saying, Diane?
Two as well.
Yeah, so the same problem as Michael really
largely,
was largely there for you. Okay, let us move on then to a French dramedy, La Belle Époque. Victor and Marianne are the two protagonists here, really. Who are they? And the La Belle Époque here... is only in 1970s, 1974, isn't it?
Belle Époque, the good times, is the titular cafe where Victor and Marianne met. They've come a long way since that. They're in trapped in a loveless marriage.
And we're talking about Fanny Ardant as Marianne and Daniel Otai as Victor.
Who really, he really looks like... the husband from Shirley Valentine. So I was kind of had to get used to that initially in the first minute or so. So that's one thing that's going on. But on the other side of it, there's Guillaume Canet's character, Antoine, who has this business where they recreate, they basically let people be tourists in their own youth.
Right.
Or any particular moment in history. So you can go back to Elizabethan times, you can go back to Napoleonic War, or as Victor chooses, he chooses to go back to La Belle Époque, the cafe where he met his beautiful wife,
Marianne,
in the 70s.
So Daniel, the marriage is in trouble at this point. They're in their 60s at this stage, and Victor and Marianne are going through certain difficulties. So he decides, well, that sounds like a good theatre for me to travel back to, and I can find out what I did wrong and how to make things better when we get to this point.
I don't know how interested he is in finding out what he did wrong. But
he's very interested in the young Marianne.
Oh, indeed, yeah.
I mean, explain, now this is quite yeah, well, it's extraordinary what they do here in terms of the casting. Tell us what happens.
The premise of this is so interesting, isn't it? Les voyageurs du temps, this idea that you can go back, you know, there's a lot in this film about technology and a kind of an attempt to marshal a response to the fact that we feel so often beset by technology, that so much of contemporary life is about being visualized and seen, and trying to reclaim that in one's own interest is kind of an idea at the heart of this movie. But I guess one other thing I was thinking about watching it is how differently French popular culture positions older people than, let's say, Hollywood does. And one thing this film has going for it is genuine, sincere interest in 60-something people, a demographic that Hollywood typically, you know, satirizes or spurns altogether. And, you know, you only have to think of, like, the career lately of Betty White to think about Hollywood's use of
But Daniel O'Tai goes back in time to 1974 as himself.
Yes.
But when he gets back there, there's a younger actor to play the part of the young Marianne.
Yeah. So it's most of the kind of middle and late sections of the film involve very much a discrepantly aged couple, because Marianne is the young Marianne and Victor is still, you know, Daniel O'Toole. Yeah. So it's a bit of a problem.
You can kind of see because Victor is kind of predictable and immature, you can kind of see where this is going from the moment he sets eyes on this young version of his wife. In La Belle Epoque, so you can kind of see where that's going. But at the same time, we have the actor is dealing with her own issues, which is Guillaume Canet's character with an earpiece in her ear, giving her all manner of comments and strange emotional abuse and kind of weird manipulation while she's trying to do her job there with Victor. And it becomes, quickly enough, it starts to become a little unsavory, shall I say?
Creepy.
There is a creepy kind of. And not so sure it recognises this.
Right. And there's always the problem when we have a dramedy, you know, does it get the balance right between drama and comedy? Does it get the balance right between drama and comedy?
I wish it had. I don't think it does. I don't think the comedy lands very well. I guess one of the things I was thinking when I watched it is it put me in mind of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind from 15 years ago, but it doesn't have the deeper feeling that made that film so impactful. And frankly, I think by the end of it, I didn't much care. You know, I didn't feel any connection to any of the major characters.
Stars from you, Diane.
Three.
I enjoyed it more than I thought. I thought the one-liners in particular were quite good, so I would give it three myself.
You give it three yourself, okay. I don't know whether you kind of have a meh week at the cinema, it sounds like to me, the two of you.
Yeah.
November week, Diane Negra and Michael Pope there speaking to us about Frozen 2, which of course is on general release, while A Dog Called Money and La Belle Epoque are both on limited release.